him, yar? Sanjay snarled. Who the fuck was he to be giving Kader Bhai warnings? Who the fuck was he to get us all in the shit with Patil? So we had to have his guys cut up old Majid. And then, after everything, he went and sold everybody out to the fucking Pakistani cops, yar. Fuck him. If I could dig the Majid up and kill him again, I'd do it today. I'd do it every day. It would be my fucking hobby, like. Who is the real Shapna? I asked. Who actually did the killings for Abdul? I remember Kader told me once, after Abdullah was killed, that he found the real Shapna. He said he killed him. Who was he? And why did he kill him if he was working for him in the first place? The two younger men turned to face Nazir. Sanjay asked him a few questions in Urdu. It was an act of respect toward the older man. They knew the facts as well as Nazir did, but they deferred to his recollection of them and included him in the discussion. I understood most of Nazir's reply, but I waited for Sanjay to translate. His name was Jitendra. Jitu Dada, they called him. He was a gun and machete guy from Delhi side. Ghani brought him down here with four other guys. He actually kept them in five-star hotels, like, the whole fucking time. 2 years, man. Bahinchut. Complaining about Kader spending money on the Mujahideen and the war and all. And meanwhile, he was keeping these psycho fuckers in five-star hotels for 2 fucking years. Jitu Dada got drunk when Abdullah was killed, Salman added. It really got to him, you know, that everyone was saying Shapna was dead. He'd been doing the Shapna thing for nearly 2 years, and it had started to twist his brain. He started to believe his own, or Ghani's, bullshit. Stupid fucking name, yeah? Sanjay cut in. It's a girl's name, Shapna. It's a fucking girl's name. It's like me calling myself fucking Lucy or some such. What kind of a bad fucker calls himself a girl's name, yeah? The kind who kills 11 people, Salman answered, and almost gets away with it. Anyway, he got completely drunk the night Abdullah was killed, and everybody was saying that Shapna was dead. And he started shooting his mouth off, telling anyone who would listen that he was the real Shapna. They're in a bar in the President Hotel. Then he starts shouting that he was ready to tell it all. Who was behind the Shapna killings, you know? And who planned it all and paid for it? Fucking Gandu, Sanjay growled, using the slang word for asshole. I never met one of these psycho types who wasn't a fucking squealer, yeah? Lucky for us, there were mostly foreigners in the place that night, so they didn't know what he was talking about. One of our guys was there in the bar, and he told Jitu to shut the fuck up. Jitu Dada said he wasn't afraid of Abdel Kader Khan, because he had plans for Kader as well. He said Kader was going to end up in pieces, just like Majid. Then he starts waving a gun around. Our guy called Kader right away. And the Khan, he went and did that one himself. He went with Nazir and Khaled, and Farid, and Ahmed Zadeh, and young Andrew Ferreira, and some others. I missed that one. Fuck it, Sanjay cursed. I wanted to fix that Makachud from the first day, and especially after Majid. But I was on a job in Goa. Anyway, Kader fixed them up. They found them near the car park of the President Hotel. Jitu Dada and his guys put up a fight. There was a big shootout. Two of our guys got hit. One of them was Hussein. You know, he runs the numbers in Ballard Pier now. That's how he lost his arm. He took a shotgun blast. Both barrels of a crowd pleaser are sawn off, and it tore his arm right off his body. If Ahmed Zadeh hadn't wrapped him up and dragged him out of there and off to hospital, he would have bled to death right there in the car park. All four of them who were there, Jitu Dada and his three guys, got wasted. Kader Bhai put the last bullets into their heads himself. But one of those Shapna guys wasn't in the car park, and he got away. We never tracked him down. He went back to Delhi, and he disappeared from there. We haven't heard anything since. I liked that Ahmedzadeh, Sanjay said quietly, dispensing what was, for him, extravagantly high praise, with a little sigh of sorrowing recollection. Yeah, I agreed, remembering the man who'd always looked as though he was searching for a friend in a crowd, the man who'd died with his hand clenched in mine. He was a good guy. Nazir spoke again, grunting the words at us in his wrathful style as if they were threats. When the Pakistani cops were tipped off about Kader Bhai, Sanjay translated, it was obvious that it had to be Abdul Ghani behind it. I nodded my agreement. It was obvious. Abdul Ghani was from Pakistan. His connections there went deep and high. He'd told me about it more than once when I'd worked for him. I wondered why I hadn't seen it at the time, when the cops raided our hotel in Pakistan. My first thought was that I'd simply liked him too much to suspect him, and that was true. More to the point, perhaps, was how flattered I'd been by his attention. Ghani had been my patron on the council, after Kader himself, and he'd invested time, energy, and affection in our friendship. And there was something else that might have distracted me in Karachi. My mind had been filled with shame and revenge. I remembered that much from the visit to the mosque, when I'd sat beside Kader Bhai and Khalid to hear the blind singers. I remembered reading Didier's letter and deciding, in that shifting yellow lamplight, that I would kill Madame Jo. I remembered thinking that and then turning my head to see the love in Kader's golden eyes. Could that love and that anger have smothered something so important, something so obvious as Ghani's treachery? And if I'd missed that, what else had I missed?
Kader wasn't supposed to make it out of Pakistan, Salman added. Kader Bhai, Nazir, Khaled, even you. Abdul Ghani thought it was his chance to take out the whole council in one shot, all the guys on the council who weren't with him. But Kader Bhai had his own friends in Pakistan, and they warned him, and you made it out of the trap. I think Abdul must have known he was finished from that day on, but he held his peace, and he didn't make any moves here. He was hoping, I guess, that Kader and the whole lot of you might be killed in the war.
Nazir interrupted him, impatient with the English that he despised. I thought I understood what he'd said, and I translated his words, looking to Sanjay for confirmation that my guess was correct. Kader told Nazir to keep the truth about Abdul Ghani a secret. He said that if anything happened to him in the war, Nazir was to return to Bombay and avenge him. Was that it?
Yeah, Sanjay wagged his head. You got it. And after we did that, we had to fix the rest of the guys who were on Ghani's side. There's none of them left now. They're all dead, or they got the fuck out of Bombay.
Which brings us to the point, Salman smiled. It was a rare smile, but a good one. A tired man's smile. An unhappy man's smile. A tough man's smile. His long face was a little lopsided, with one eye lower than the other by the thickness of a finger, a break in his nose that had settled crookedly, and a mouth that hitched in one corner, where a fist had split the lip and a suture had pulled the skin too tightly. His short hair formed a perfect round hairline on his brow, like a dark halo that pressed down hard on his slightly jugged ears.
We want you to run the passports for a while. Krishna and Vilu are very insistent. They're a little...
They're freaked out of their fucking brains, Sanjay cut in. They're scared stupid because guys were getting chopped all over Bombay, starting with Ghani while they were right there in the fucking cellar. Now the war's over and we won, but they're still scared. We can't afford to lose them, Lin. We want you to work with them and settle them down like. They're asking about you all the time and they want you to work with them. They like you, man.
I looked at each of them in turn and settled my eyes on Nazir. If my understanding was correct, it was a tempting offer. The victorious Kader faction had reformed the local mafia council under old Shaban Mahmud. Nazir had become a full member of the council, as had Mahmud Melbaf.
The others included Sanjay and Salman, Farid, and three other Bombay-born dons. All of the last six spoke Marathi every bit as well as they spoke Hindi or English. That gave me a unique and very significant point of contact with them, because I was the only Gora any of them knew who could speak Marathi. I was the only Gora any of them knew who'd been leg-ironed at Arthur Road Prison. And I was one of the very few men, brown or white, who'd survived Khader's war. They liked me, they trusted me. They saw me as a valuable asset. The gangster war was over. In the new Pax Mafia that ruled their part of the city, fortunes could be made. And I needed the money. I'd been living on my savings, and I was almost broke. "What exactly did you have in mind?" I asked Nazir, knowing that Sanjay would reply.
"You run the books, the stamps, all the passport stuff, and the licenses, permits, and credit cards," he answered quickly. "You get complete control. Just the way it was with Ghani. No fucking problem. Whatever you need, you get it. You take a piece of that action. I'm thinking about 5%. But we can talk about that if you don't think it's enough, yeah."
"And you can visit the council whenever you want," Salman added. "Sort of an observer status, if you get my meaning. What do you say?" "You'd have to move the operation from Ghani's basement," I said quietly. "I'd never feel happy about working there, and I'm not surprised the place has got Vilu and Krishna spooked."
"No problem," Sanjay laughed, slapping the table. "We're going to sell the place anyway. You know, Lin brother, that fat fuck Ghani put the two big houses, his own one and the place next door, in his brother-in-law's name. Nothing wrong with that. Fuck, man, we all do that. But they're worth fucking crores, Lin. They're fucking mansions, Baba. And then, after we sliced and diced the fat fuck, his brother-in-law decides he doesn't want to sign the places over to us. Then he gets tough and starts talking lawyers and police. So we had to tie him up over a big dubber of acid, yeah? Then he's not tough anymore. Then he can't wait to sign the places over to us. We sent Farid to do the job. He took care of it. But he got so fucked up, yeah, with the disrespect Ghani's brother-in-law showed us. And he was real angry with the Madjud for making him set up the acid barrel and all. He likes to keep things simple, our brother Farid. The whole hanging the cunt up over the acid thing, it was all a bit... What did you call it, Salman? What was the word?"
"Tawdry," Salman suggested.
"Yeah, taw-fucking-dry, the whole thing. Farid, he likes to get respect, or cut to the chase and gun the motherfucker down like. So, angry as he is, he takes the brother-in-law's own house as well. Makes him sign over his own house, just for being such a big mudchud about Ghani's houses. So now he's got nothing, that guy. And we got three houses on the market instead of one."
"It's a vicious and bloodthirsty racket, that property business," Salman concluded with a wry smile. "I'm moving us into it as soon as I can. We're taking over one of the big agencies. I've got Farid working on it. Okay, Lin, if you don't want to work at Ghani's place, where would you like us to set it up for you?"
"I like Tadaya," I suggested. "Somewhere near Haji Ali." "Why Tadeo?" Sanjay asked.
"I like Tadaya. It's clean, and it's quiet, and it's near Haji Ali. I like Haji Ali. I've got a kind of a sentimental connection to the place."
"Tik hai, Lin," Salman agreed. "Tadeo it is. We'll tell Farid to start looking right away. Anything else?"
"I'll need a couple of runners, guys I can trust. I'd like to pick my own men."
"Who have you got in mind?" Sanjay asked.
"You don't know them. They're outside guys, but they're both good men. Johnny Sagar and Kishore. I trust them, and I know I can rely on them." Sanjay and Salman exchanged a glance and looked to Nazir. He nodded.
"No problem," Salman said. "Is that it?"
"One more thing," I added, turning to Nazir. "I want Nazir as my contact on the council. If there's any problem for any reason, I want to deal with Nazir first." Nazir nodded again, favouring me with a little smile deep in his eyes. I shook hands with each man in turn to seal the deal.
The exchange was a little more formal and solemn than I'd expected it to be, and I had to clench my jaw to stifle a laugh. And those attitudes, their gravitas, and my recusant impulse to laugh, registered the difference between us, for all that I liked Salman, Sanjay, and the others. And the truth was that I loved Nazir and owed him my life. The mafia was, for me, a means to an end, and not an end in itself. For them, the mafia was a family, an infrangible bond that held them from minute to minute and all the way to the dying breath. Their solemnity expressed that kin-sacred obligation from eye to eye and hand to hand. But I knew they never believed it was like that for me. They took me in and worked with me. The white guy, the wild Gora who went to the war with Abdelkader Khan. But they expected me to leave them, sooner or later, and return to the other world of my memory and my blood. I didn't think that, and I didn't expect it, because I'd burned all the bridges that might have led me home. And although I had to stop myself from laughing at the earnestness of the little ceremony, the handshake had, in fact, formally inducted me into the ranks of professional criminals. Until that moment, the crimes I'd committed had been in the service of Kader Khan. As difficult as it is for anyone outside that world to understand, there was a sense in which I'd been able to say, with sincerity, that I'd committed them for love of him. For my own safety, certainly, but beyond every other reason, for the father's love I'd craved from him. With Kader gone, I could have made the break completely. I could have gone almost anywhere. I could have done something else. But I didn't. I joined my fate to theirs and became a gangster for nothing more than the money and the power and the protection that their brotherhood promised. And it kept me busy, breaking laws for a living. So busy that I managed to hide most of what I felt from the heart that was feeling it. Everything moved quickly after that meeting at the Macambo. Farid found new premises within a week. The two-story building, only a short walk from the floating mosque, Haji Ali, had been a records office for a branch of the Bombay Municipal Corporation. When the BMC had moved to larger, more modern offices, they'd left most of the old benches, desks, storage cupboards and shelves behind as stock fittings. They were well suited to our needs, and I spent a week supervising a team of cleaners and labourers who dusted and polished every surface while moving the furniture around to make way for the machinery and light tables from Ghani's basement. Our men loaded that specialist equipment onto a large covered truck and delivered it to the new premises late at night. The street was unusually quiet as the heavy truck backed up to the double folding doors of our new factory. But alarm bells and the heavier clang of fire engine bells jangled in the distance. Standing beside our truck, I looked along the deserted street in the direction of the frantic sound. "It must be a big fire," I muttered to Sanjay, and he laughed out loud.
"Farid started a fire," Salman said, answering for his friend. "We told him we didn't want anyone watching us move this stuff into the new place, so he started the fire as a diversion. That's why the street is so empty. Everybody who is awake has gone to the fire."
"He burned down a rival company," Sanjay laughed. "Now we are officially in the real estate business because our biggest rivals have just closed down due to fire damage. We start our new real estate office not far from here tomorrow. And tonight, no curious fuckers are here to see us move our stuff into your new workshop. Farid killed two birds with one match, nah."
So, while fire and smoke singed the midnight sky, and bells and sirens railed about a kilometre away, we directed our men as they moved the heavy equipment into the new factory. And Krishna and Vilu went to work almost at once. In the months that I'd been away, Ghani had followed my suggestion to push the focus of the operation laterally into the production of permits, certificates, diplomas, licences, letters of credit, security passes, and other documents. It was a booming trade in the booming economy of Bombay, and we often worked through the dawn to satisfy the demand. And the business was generational. As licensing authorities and other bodies modified their documents in response to our forgeries, we dutifully copied and then counterfeited them again, at additional cost.
It's a kind of Red Queen contest, I said to Salman Mustan, when the new passport factory had been running for 6 diligent months.
Lalka Rani? He asked.
A Red Queen? Yeah, it's a biology thing. It's about hosts, like human bodies, and parasites, like viruses and such. I studied it when I was running my clinic in the Jhopadpati. The hosts, our bodies, and the viruses, any bug that makes us sick, are locked in a competition with each other. When the parasite attacks, the host develops a defense. Then the virus changes to beat that defense, so the host gets a new defense, and that keeps on going. They call it a Red Queen contest. It's from the story, you know, Alice in Wonderland.
I know it, Salman answered. We did it at school, but I never understood it.
That's okay, nobody does. Anyway, the little girl, Alice, she meets this Red Queen, who runs incredibly fast but never seems to get anywhere. She tells Alice that in her country it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. And that's like us with the passport authorities and the licensing boards and the banks all over the world. They keep changing the passports and other documents to make it harder for us, and we keep finding new ways to fake them. And they keep changing the way they make them, and we keep finding new ways to fake them and forge them and adapt them for ourselves. It's a Red Queen contest, and we all have to run real fast just to stand still.
I think you're doing better than standing still, he asserted.
His tone was quiet but adamant.
You've done a damn fine job, Lin. The ID stuff is deadly. It's a real big market. They can't get enough. And it's good work. So far, all our guys who've used your books have gone through without any problems, yeah. As a matter of fact, that's why I've called you to have lunch with us today. I've got a surprise for you. Kind of a present-like. And I'm sure you're going to like it. It's a way of saying thanks, yeah, for the great job you've been doing.
I didn't look at him. We were walking quickly, side by side, along Mahatma Gandhi Road, toward the Regal Circle roundabout, on a hot, cloudless afternoon. Where the footpath was clogged with shoppers halting at the tabletop street stalls, we walked on the road with a slow, unceasing stream of traffic behind and beside us. I didn't look at Salman, because I'd come to know him well enough during those 6 months to be sure he was embarrassed by the praise he'd felt moved to lavish on me. Salman was a natural leader, but like many men who have the gift of command and the instinct to rule, he was deeply troubled by every expression of the leadership art. He was at heart a humble man, and that humility made him an honourable man. Letty had once said that she found it strange and incongruous to hear me describe criminals, killers and mafiosi as men of honour. The confusion, I think, was hers, not mine. She'd confused honour with virtue. Virtue is concerned with what we do, and honour is concerned with how we do it. You can fight a war in an honourable way. The Geneva Convention exists for that very reason. And you can enforce the peace without any honour at all. In its essence, honour is the art of being humble. And gangsters, just like cops, politicians, soldiers, and holy men, are only ever good at what they do if they stay humble.
You know, he remarked, as we moved to the wider footpath opposite the cloisters of the university buildings. I'm glad it didn't work out with your friends. The ones who wanted to help you with the passports right at the start.
I frowned and remained silent, keeping pace with his rapid step. Johnny Sagar and Kishore had refused to join me in the passport factory, and it had shocked and disappointed me. I'd assumed that they would jump at the chance to make money, to make more money with me than either of them had ever dreamed of making alone. I'd never anticipated the saddened and offended expressions that closed their smiles when they understood, at last, that I was offering them nothing more than the golden opportunity to commit crimes with me. It had never occurred to me that they wouldn't want to do it. It had never occurred to me that they would refuse to work with criminals, and for criminals. I remembered turning away from their stony, closed, embarrassed smiles that day. I remembered the question that had knotted into a fist in my mind, right behind the eyes. Was I so far out of touch with the thoughts and feelings of decent men. The question still rankled 6 months later. The answer still stared back at me from the mirrored windows of the shops we passed as we walked.
"If those guys of yours had worked out," Salman continued, "I wouldn't have put Farid with you, and I'm damn glad that I did put him with you. He's a much happier guy now. He's a much more relaxed kind of guy. He likes you, Lin."
"I like him too," I replied quickly, smiling through my frown. And it was true. I did like Farid, and I was glad that we'd become close friends. Farid, the shy but capable youngster I'd met on my first visit to Kader's Mafia Council more than 3 years before, had toughened up to a hard, fearless, angry man whose sense of loyalty assumed the full measure of his young life. When Johnny Cigar and Kishore rejected my offers of work, Salman had put Farid and the Goan, Andrew Ferreira, to work with me. Andrew had been genial and talkative, but he'd moved only reluctantly from the company of his young gangster friends, and we hadn't become close. Farid, however, had spent most days and many nights with me, and we liked and understood one another.
"He was right on the edge, I think, when Kader died and we had to clean out Ghani's guys," Salman confided. "It got pretty rough. You remember? We all did some unusual things. But Farid was wild. He was starting to worry me. You have to get heavy sometimes in our business. That's just how it is. But you got a problem on your hands when you start to enjoy it, nah? I had to talk to him. 'Farid,' I said to him, 'cutting people up should not be the first option. It should be a long way down the list. It shouldn't even be on the same page as the first option.' But he went right on doing it. Then I put him with you. And now, after 6 months, he's a much calmer guy. It worked out well, yeah. I think I'll just have to put all the really bad and mad motherfuckers with you, Lin, to straighten them out."
"He blamed himself for not being there when Kader died," I said, as we rounded the curve of the domed Jahangir Art Gallery. Seeing a small gap in the traffic, we jogged across the roundabout at Regal Circle Junction, dodging and weaving between the cars.
"We all did," Salman muttered softly, when we took up a position outside the Regal Cinema.
It was a tiny phrase, three small words, and it said nothing new, nothing more than I already knew to be true. Yet that little phrase thundered in my heart, and an avalanche of grieving began to tremble, shift and slide. For almost a year, and until that very moment, my anger at Kaderbai had shielded me from the pain of grieving for him. Others had crumbled and withered and raged in their shock and sorrow at his death. I'd been so angry with him that my share of grief was still up there, beneath the smothering snow, in those mountains where he'd died. I'd felt a sense of loss. I'd suffered almost from the start. And I didn't hate the Khan. I'd loved him always, and still loved him in that instant as we stood outside the cinema waiting for our friends. But I hadn't really grieved for him, not in the way that I'd grieved for Prabhakar or even Abdullah. Somehow, Salman's casual remark that we all blamed ourselves for not being with Kader when he died had shaken my frozen sorrowing free, and the slow, inexorable snowslip of its heartache began, right there and then.
"We must be a bit early," Salman observed cheerily,
and I flinched as I forced myself into the moment with him.
"Yeah. They're coming by car, we're walking, and still we beat them here."
"It's a good walk. At night it's even better. I do that walk a lot, the causeway to VT and back. It's one of my favourite walks in the whole city." Salman looked at me, a smile on his lips, and a frown exaggerating the slightly crooked tilt of his almond-brown eyes.
"You really love this place, don't you?" he asked.
"Sure I do," I replied, a little defensively. "That doesn't mean I like everything about it. There's a lot that I don't like. But I do love the place. I love Bombay, and I think I always will." He grinned and looked away down the street.
I struggled to hold the set of my features, to keep my expression calm and even, but it was too late. The heart grief had already begun. I know now what was happening to me, what was overwhelming me, what was about to consume and almost destroy me. Didier had even given me a name for it. Assassin grief, he'd once called it. The kind of grief that lies in wait and attacks from ambush, with no warning and no mercy. I know now that assassin grief can hide for years and then strike suddenly, on the happiest day, without discernible reason or exegesis. But on that day, 6 months after my work in the passport factory had begun, and almost a year after Kader's death, I couldn't understand the dark and trembling mood that was moving in me, swelling to the sorrow I'd too long denied. I couldn't understand it, so I tried to fight it, as a man fights pain or despair. But you can't bite down on assassin grief and will it away. The enemy stalks you, step for step, and knows your every move before you make it. The enemy is your own grieving heart, and when it strikes, it can't miss. Salman turned to me once more, his amber eyes gleaming in the cast of his thoughts. That time, when we had the war to get rid of Ghani's guys, Farid was trying to be a new Abdullah. He loved him, you know. He loved him like a brother. And I think he was trying to be Abdullah. I think he got the idea that we needed a new Abdullah to win the war for us. But it doesn't work, does it? I tried to tell him that. I tell that to all the young guys, especially the ones who try to be like me. You can only ever be yourself. The more you try to be like someone else, the more you find yourself standing in the way. Hey, here's the guys. A white ambassador stopped in front of us. Farid, Sanjay, Andrew Ferreira, and a tough 40-year-old Bombay Muslim named Amir got out of the car and joined us. We shook hands as the car drove off. Let's wait a minute, guys, while Faisal parks the car, Sanjay suggested. It was true that Faisal, who ran the protection racket with Amir, was parking the car. It was also true, and more to the point, that Sanjay was enjoying himself, standing in our conspicuous group on a warm afternoon and sparking furtive but fervent looks from most of the girls passing us on the busy street. We were gundas, gangsters, and almost everyone knew it. Our clothes were new and expensive and cut to the edge of fashion. We were all fit, we were all confident, we were all armed and dangerous. Faisal loped around the corner and wagged his head to signal that the car was safely parked. We joined him and walked the 3 blocks to the Taj Mahal Hotel in a single wide line. The route from Regal Circle to the Taj Hotel crossed spacious, open, crowded squares. We held our line easily as the crowds parted for us. Heads turned as we passed, and whispers whirled in our wake. We climbed the white marble steps at the Taj and walked through to the Shamiana restaurant on the ground floor. 2 waiters settled our group at a long reserved table near a tall window with a courtyard view. I sat at one end of the table, nearest to the exit. The strange and overpoweringly dark mood that had stirred in me with Salman's little phrase grew stronger by the minute. I wanted to be free to leave at any moment, without upsetting the balance of the group. The waiters greeted me with broad smiles, calling me Gao Alai, or countryman, the Indian equivalent of the Italian paisano. They knew me well, the Gora who spoke Marathi, and we chatted for a while in the village dialect I'd learned in Sunda more than 4 years before. Food arrived, and the men ate with good appetite. I too was hungry, but I couldn't eat, and I just pushed at the food to make a polite show. I drank 2 cups of black coffee and tried to bring my troubled, storming mind into the run of conversations. Amir was describing the movie he'd seen the night before, a Hindi gangster picture in which the gangsters were vicious thugs and the hero conquered them all, unarmed and alone. He described every fight sequence in detail, and the men hooted with laughter. Amir was a scarred, blunt-headed man, with thick, tangled eyebrows and a moustache that rode the cresting wave of his full upper lip, like the wide prow of a Kashmiri houseboat. He loved to laugh and tell stories, and his self-assured, sonorous voice compelled attention. Amir's constant companion, Faisal, had been a champion boxer in the youth league. On his 19th birthday, after a year of tough professional bouts, he discovered that his manager had embezzled and squandered all the money he'd been entrusted to save from his boxer's fights. Faisal had tracked the manager down. When he'd found him, he hit him and then kept on hitting him until the man was dead. He'd served 8 years in prison for the crime and was banned from boxing for life. In prison, the naive, hot-tempered teenager had become a calculating, cold-tempered young man. One of Kadarbai's talent scouts had recruited him in the prison, and he'd served his apprenticeship to the mafia through the last 3 years of his sentence. During the 4 years since his release, Faisal had worked as Amir's principal strong-arm man in the burgeoning protection racket. He was quick, ruthless, and driven to succeed at whatever task was set for him. His flattened, broken nose and a neat scar that dissected his left eyebrow gave him a fearsome appearance and toughened what might otherwise have been a too regular and too handsome face. They were the new blood, the new mafia dons, the new lords of the city. Sanjay, the efficient killer with the movie star looks. Andrew, the genial Goan who dreamed of taking his seat on the mafia council. Amir, the grizzled veteran with the storyteller's gift. Faisal, the cold-hearted enforcer who only asked one question: finger, arm, leg, or neck, when he was given an assignment. Farid, known as the fixer, who solved problems with fire and fear, and who'd raised 6 much younger brothers and sisters alone when his parents died in a cholera-infested slum. And Salman, the quiet one, the humble one, the natural leader, who controlled the lives of hundreds in the little empire that he'd inherited and held by force. And they were my friends. More than friends, they were my brothers in their brotherhood of crime. We were bonded to one another in blood, not all of it other people's, and boundless obligation. If I needed them, no matter what I'd done, no matter what I wanted them to do, they would come. If they needed me, I was there, without cavil or regret. They knew they could count on me. They knew that when Kader had asked me to join him in his war, I'd gone with him, and I'd put my life on the line. I knew I could count on them. When I'd needed him, Abdullah had been there to help me deal with Maurizio's body. It's a significant test, asking someone to help you dispose of a murdered man's body. Not many pass it. Every man at the table had passed that test, some of them more than once. They were a solid crew, to use the Australian prison slang. They were the perfect crew for me, an outlaw with a price on my head. I'd never felt so safe, not even with Kadarbai's protection. And I never should have felt alone. But I was alone, and for 2 reasons. The mafia was theirs, not mine. For them, the organisation always came first. But I was loyal to the men, not the mafia. To the brothers, not the brotherhood. I worked for the mafia, but I didn't join it. I'm not a joiner. I never found a club or clan or idea that was more important to me than the men and women who believed in it. And there was another difference between the men in that group and me, a difference so profound that friendship on its own couldn't surmount it. I was the only man at that table who hadn't killed a human being, in hot blood or cold. Even Andrew, amiable and garrulous young Andrew, had fired his Beretta at a cornered enemy, one of the Shapna killers, and emptied all 7 rounds of the magazine into the man's chest until he was, as Sanjay would have said, 2 or 3 times dead. Just at that moment, the differences suddenly seemed immense and unconquerable to me. Far greater and more significant than the 100 talents, desires and tendencies that we had in common. I was slipping away from them, right there and then, at the long table in the Taj. While Amir told his stories, and I tried to nod and smile and laugh with the others, grief came to claim me. The day that had started well, and should have been like any other, had spun askew with Salman's little words. The room was warm, but I was cold. My belly hungered, but I couldn't eat. I was surrounded by friends in a vast, crowded restaurant, but I was lonelier than a Mujahideen sentry on the night before battle. And then I looked up to see Lisa Carter walk into the restaurant. Her long blonde hair had been cut. The new short style suited her open, honest, pretty face. She was dressed in pale blue, her favourite colour. A loose shirt and pants, with matching blue sunglasses propped in her thick hair. She looked like a creature of light, a creature made out of sky and clean white light. Without considering what I was doing, I stood and excused myself and left my friends. She saw me as I approached her. A smile as big as a gambler's promise unveiled her face as she opened her arms to hug me. And then she knew. One hand reached up to touch my face, her fingertips reading the braille of scars, while the other hand took my arm to lead me out of the restaurant and into the foyer. "I haven't seen you for weeks," she said as we sat together in a quiet corner. "What's wrong?" "Nothing," I lied. "Were you going in to have some lunch?"
"No, just coffee. I've got a room here in the old part, looking out over the gateway. It's a million-dollar view and a great room. I've got it for 3 days while Letty sews up a deal with a big producer. This is one of the fringe benefits she managed to squeeze out of him. The movie business. What can I say?"
"How's it going?"
"Great," she smiled. "Letty loves every minute of it. She deals with all the studios and the booking agents now. She's better at it than me. She drives a better deal for us every time. And I do the tourists. I like that part better. I like meeting them and working with them."
"And you like it that sooner or later, no matter how nice they are, they always go away?"
"Yeah, that too.
How's Vikram? I haven't seen him since the last time I saw you and Letty."
"He's cool. You know Vikram? He's got a lot more time on his hands now. He misses the stunt thing. He was really big on that, and he was great at it, but it drove Letty crazy. He was always jumping off moving trucks and crashing through windows and stuff, and she worried a lot. So she made him give it up."
"What's he doing now?"
"He's kind of the boss, you know? Like the executive vice president of the company. The one Letty started with Kavita and Carla and Jeet. And me."
She paused, on the verge of saying something, and then plunged on.
"She was asking after you."
I stared back at her, saying nothing.
"Carla," she explained. "She wants to see you, I think."
I held the silence. I was enjoying it a little, that so many emotions were chasing one another across the soft, unblemished landscape of her face.
"Have you seen any of his stunts?" she asked.
"Vikram's?"
"Yeah. He did a whole lot before Letty made him stop."
"I've been busy. But I really want to catch up with Vikram."
"Why don't you?"
"I will. I heard he's hanging out at the Kalaba market every day, and I've been wanting to see him. I'm working a lot of nights, so I haven't been to Leopold's lately. It's just, I've been busy."
"I know," she said softly. "Maybe too busy, Lynn. You don't look too good."
"Give me a break," I sighed, trying to laugh. "I work out every day. I do boxing or karate every other day. I can't get any fitter than this."
"You know what I mean," she insisted.
"Yeah, I know what you mean. Listen, I should let you go."
"No, you shouldn't."
"I shouldn't?" I asked, faking a smile.
"No, you should come with me now to my room. We can have coffee sent up. Come on, let's go."
And she was right.
It was a spectacular view. Tourist ferries, bound for the caves on Elephanta Island, or returning to shore, rose up the wavelets and rolled over them in proud, practiced glissades. Hundreds of smaller craft dipped and nodded like preening birds in the shallow water, while huge cargo vessels, anchored to the horizon, lay motionless on that cusp of calm where the ocean became the bay. On the street below us, parading tourists wove coloured garlands with their movements through and around the tall stony gallery of the Gateway Monument. She kicked off her shoes and sat cross-legged on the bed. I sat near her on the edge of the bed. I stared at the floor near the door. We were quiet for a while, listening to the noises that pushed their way into the room with a breeze that caused the curtains to riffle, swell, and fall. "I think," she began, taking a deep breath, "you should come and live with me."
"Well, let's..."
"Hear me out," she cut in, raising both palms to silence me. "Please."
"I just don't think..."
"Please."
"Okay," I smiled, sitting further along the bed to rest my back against the bedhead.
"I found a new place. It's in Tardeo. I know you like Tardeo. So do I. And I know you'll like the apartment because it's exactly the kind of place we both like. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at, or trying to say. We like the same things, Lynn. And we got a lot in common. We both beat the dope. That's a fucking hard thing to do, and you know it. And not many people do it, but we did. We both did. And I think that's because we're alike, you and me. We'd be good, Lynn. We'd be real good."
"I can't say for sure that I beat the dope, Lisa."
"You did, Lynn."
"No. I can't say I won't ever touch it again. So I can't say I beat it."
"But that's even more reason to get together, don't you see?" she insisted, her eyes pleading and close to tears. "I'll keep you straight. I can say I won't ever touch it again, because I hate the stuff. If we're together, we can work the movie business and have fun and watch out for each other."
"There's too much."
"Listen, if you're worried about Australia and jail, we could go somewhere else. Somewhere they'll never find us."
"Who told you about that?" I asked, keeping my face straight.
"Carla did," she answered evenly. "It was in the same little conversation we had once where she told me to look after you."
"Carla said that?"
"Yeah."
"When?"
"A long time ago. I asked her about you, about what her feelings were, and what she wanted to do."
"Why?"
"What do you mean, why?"
"I mean," I replied slowly, reaching out to cover her hand with mine. "Why did you ask Carla about her feelings?"
"Because I had a crush on you, stupid," she explained,
holding my eye for a second and then looking away again.
"That's why I went with Abdullah, to make you jealous or interested, and just to be close to you through him, because he was your friend."
"Jesus," I sighed. "I'm sorry."
"Is it still Carla?" she asked,
her eyes following the rise and breathless fall of the curtains at the window.
"Are you still in love with her?"
"No."
"But you still love her?"
"Yes."
"And how about me?" she asked.
I didn't answer because I didn't want her to know the truth. I didn't want to know the truth myself. And the silence thickened and swelled until I could feel the tingling pressure of it on my skin.
"I've got this friend," she said at last. "He's an artist, a sculptor. His name's Jason. Have you ever met him?"
"No, I don't think so."
"He's an English guy. And he's got a real English way of looking at things. It's different than our way. Our American way, I mean. He's got a big studio out near Juhu Beach. I go there sometimes. She was silent again. We sat there, feeling the breeze alternately warm and cool as the air from the street and the bay swirled into the room. I could feel her eyes on me like a blush of shame. I stared at our two hands joined and resting on the bed. The last time I went there, he was working on this new idea. He was filling empty packaging with plaster, using the bubble packs that used to have toys in them, you know, and the foam boxes you get packed around a new TV set. He calls them negative spaces. He uses them like a mold, and he makes a sculpture out of them. He had 100 things there, shapes made out of egg cartons and the blister pack that a new toothbrush came in, and the empty package that had a set of headphones in it. I turned to look at her. The sky in her eyes held tiny storms. Her lips, embossed with secret thoughts, were swollen to the truth she was trying to tell me. I walked around there, in his studio, you know, looking at all these white sculptures, and I thought, that's what I am. That's what I've always been, all my life. Negative space. Always waiting for someone or something or some kind of real feeling to fill me up and give me a reason. When I kissed her, the storm from her blue eyes came into our mouths, and the tears that slid across her lemon-scented skin were sweeter than honey from the sacred bees in Momba Devi's jasmine temple garden. I let her cry for us. I let her live and die for us in the long, slow stories our bodies told. Then, when the tears stopped, she surrounded us with poised and fluent beauty, a beauty that was hers alone, born in her brave heart and substantialized in the truth of her love and her flesh. And it almost worked. We kissed again as I prepared to leave her room. Good friends, lovers, gathered into one another then and forever by the clash and caress of our bodies, but not quite healed by it, not quite cured by it. Not yet. She's still there, isn't she? Lisa said, wrapping a towel around her body to stand in the breeze at the window. I've got the blues today, Lisa. I don't know why. It's been a long day. But that's nothing to do with us. You and me. That was good. For me, anyway.
For me, too. But I think she's still there, Lynn.
No, I wasn't lying before. I'm not in love with her anymore. Something happened when I came back from Afghanistan. Or maybe it happened in Afghanistan. It just stopped.
I'm going to tell you something, she murmured,
and then turned to face me, speaking in a stronger, clearer voice.
It's about her. I believe you what you said, but I think you have to know this before you can really say it's over with her.
I don't need...
Please, Lynn. It's a girl thing. I have to tell you, because you can't really say it's over with her unless you know the truth about her. Unless you know what makes her tick. If I tell you, and it doesn't change anything or make you feel different than how you feel now, then I'll know you're free.
And if it does make a difference...
Well, maybe she deserves a second chance. I don't know. I can only tell you I never understood Carla at all until she told me. She made sense after that. So, I guess you have to know. Anyway, if there's anything gonna happen for us, I want it to be clear. The past, I mean.
Okay, I relented, sitting in a chair near the door. Go ahead, She sat on the bed once more, drawing her knees up under her chin in the tight wrap of the towel. There were changes in her, and I couldn't help noticing them. A kind of honesty, maybe, in the way her body moved, and a new, almost languorous release that softened her eyes. They were love changes, and beautiful for that. And I wondered if she saw any of them in me, sitting still and quiet near the door. "Did Carla tell you why she left the States?" she asked, knowing the answer. "No," I replied, choosing not to repeat the little that Khaled had told me on the night that he walked into the snow. "I didn't think so. She told me she wasn't going to tell you about it. I said she was crazy. I said she had to level with you. But she wouldn't. It's funny how it goes, isn't it? I wanted her to tell you then, because I thought it might put you off her. Now I'm telling you so that you can give her one more chance, if you want to. Anyway, here it is. Carla left the States because she had to. She was running away because she killed a guy." I laughed. It was a small chuckle at first, but it rolled and rumbled helplessly into a belly laugh. I doubled over, leaning on my thighs for support. "It's really not that funny, Lynn," Lisa frowned. "No," I laughed, struggling to regain control. "It's not that. It's just... shit. If you knew how many times I worried about bringing my crazy fucked up life to her. I kept telling myself I had no right to love her because I was on the run. You got to admit, it's pretty funny." She stared at me, rocking slightly as she hugged her knees. She wasn't laughing. "Okay," I exhaled, pulling myself together. "Okay, go on." "There was this guy," she continued, in a tone that made it clear how serious she considered the subject. "He was the father of one of the kids she used to babysit for when she was a kid herself. She told me about it."
"She did? Okay, then you know. And nobody did anything about it. And it messed her up pretty bad. And then one day she got herself a gun. And she went to his house when he was alone. And she shot him. 6 times. 2 in the chest, she said, and 4 in the crotch.
"Did they know it was her?"
"She's not sure. She knows she didn't leave any prints there at the house. And nobody saw her leave. She got rid of the gun. And she scrammed out of there, right out of the country real fast. She's never been back, so she doesn't know if there's a sheet on her or not."
I sat back in the chair and let out a long, slow breath. Lisa watched me closely, her blue eyes narrowing slightly and reminding me of the way she'd looked at me on that night, years before, in Carla's apartment. "Is there any more?"
"No,"
she answered, shaking her head slowly, but holding my eyes in the stare.
"That's it."
"Okay," I sighed, running a hand over my face and standing to leave. I went to her and knelt on the bed beside her, with my face close to hers. "I'm glad you told me, Lisa. It makes a lot of things clearer, I guess. But it doesn't change anything in how I feel. I'd like to help her if I could, but I can't forget what happened. And I can't forgive it either. I wish I could. It'd make things a lot easier. It's bad loving someone you can't forgive."
"It's not as bad as loving someone you can't have," she countered.
And I kissed her. I rode the elevator down to the foyer, alone with the crowd of my mirror selves. Beside and behind me,
still and silent. Not one of them was able to meet my eye.